your total health environment with a whole group of experts, advocates, activists, and wise people that connect the dots between what goes on in our total world and how it affects health. Be with us every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for Connect the Dots. Progressive Radio Network, we're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. The number one station for progressive minds. Progressive minds.
Michael Rupert, Tracker of Truth, joining you on Sunday, the 7th of April, 2013. World's hanging in there, and so are we. It's been a bad week for oil companies, everybody. They had major spills in Arkansas, Alberta, Canada, Minnesota, and Texas. Yeah, all that stuff that, well, it's oil if they want to tell everybody in the world how the energy crisis is solved. But when it comes time to cleaning it up for Exxon, I guess it's not oil. It's what it really is, bitumen. So they are exempt from having to pay fines for having dumped, I don't know, 10, 20,000 gallons in an Arkansas neighborhood. It's like trying to make sense out of this anymore doesn't make sense. And if you live near the Hanford nuclear waste site in Washington, which we know is leaking from six or seven underground storage containers, there's a new report that came out of Common Dreams this week on April 5th that there's a major risk of a hydrogen explosion, just like the one that took the reactor 3, I believe it was, at Fukushima, reactor 2 or 3, just blew it. I think it was 3, just, hundreds of thousands of feet in the air. So there's that risk now brewing in Washington as the water tables are drying up and getting poisoned everywhere. There are now 18 H7N9 bird flu cases near Shanghai. That's where they found the 17,000 dead pigs in the river, along with the 5 black swans and several thousand dead ducks. And all poultry trade has been banned in Nanjing province, all around there. So nobody's buying or selling or moving any live chickens anymore, and they're actually killing a lot of them. Food prices are going up everywhere. Probably one of the biggest slaps in the face this week for Business Insider, Ecuador is going to sell a third of its Amazonian rainforest to Chinese oil companies. And actually, it's not a voluntary sell. China conveniently lent the Ecuadorian government $7 billion, which Ecuador, of course, couldn't pay. And now it's some of the most pristine rainforest that's left up at the headwaters of the Amazon. And that's going to Chinese oil companies, and that's going to get thrashed and burned. I mean, we've been living with this for weeks now about how the situation in the world outside is horrific. I'm thinking of Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now, the horror, but the horror increases and it grows. And it gets worse every day. And, of course, we're all aware of that now. What I've been developing here spiritually is what has come to me through a lot of my spiritual work over the last year, and thanks to some Native American medicine men, especially Sal Gencarelli of the Godfrey Chips family, who helped me understand the significance of the sacred blades that I carry, that I see that on the one hand, as the conditions in the outer world get worse, we hope for and believe that rising to meet that on the other side of the blade, forming a sharp edge of consciousness, is a shift, the awakening, is the emergence of a new fifth-dimensional Gaian consciousness, whatever we want to call it. And our guest tonight, Charles Eisenstein, I mean, I'd look at some of the places where he has been speaking, and he's been speaking in Turkey. He was, I believe it was the Wharton School of Business Redefining Value Conference, Biodynamics Conference. He gave the keynote, the Living in the New Economy Conference. He gave the keynote, I don't know what Kripalu, if I say that right, workshop is, the PASA conference, Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. He was the keynote there. He's done a TEDx at Whitechapel. He was not censored, like our friends Graham Hancock and Rupert Sheldrake, where we'll talk to him about that. His name is Charles Eisenstein. He's a favorite here on the show. I have quoted him and referred to him many, many times. I quoted him at my speech in Portland, Oregon in 2011. And he's a graduate of Yale, degrees in math and philosophy. He's lived in China. He's been a translator. He's a hugely prolific writer. His two best-known books are The Ascent of Humanity and Sacred Economics. But he is one of the hottest tickets around right now, and he's resonating. He's going to be here in Colorado next week, and I will be there for all 3 days of the events, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We'll give you details on that tonight. And we will be doing next week's show, meaning me and Carolyn Baker, our old friend who sits in for me when I'm not, we'll be from her house after having gone to Boulder for all 3 days and all four events there. And I am going because I want to know, I want to see, I want to put my ear to the ground. I'm a scout, I'm a tracker, I want to sense, I want to get a read on the crowds that are there, and especially on this consciousness, which I do see flowering, and which Charles Eisenstein, to me, is a great guide on or standard bearer for. There are a great many leaders emerging, but he is so eloquent and he's hot. And so why don't I just shut up and say, Charles, welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be back.
Hey, man. How are you?
Good.
You are busy.
Yeah. Things have been quite a ride, actually.
I remember when I started my lecture life in 2000 with my first university lecture at USC, and between 2000 and 2006, I gave like 80 lectures in six countries, and it was tiring. It is a demand. How are you holding up with all this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I am actually, I've been feeling like it's been unsustainable, the pace I've been keeping and you know, paying a price in terms of health and family and friends and everything. And you know, there's one part of me that, you know, listens to all the kinds of headlines you were just talking about and says, oh, gotta be more urgent, you know, gotta put out everything.
Yes.
And there's another part of me that says this urgency is part of the problem.
Yes.
And we've been sacrificing the precious things right in front of our face for a long time, and that's what our civilization is built on. Mm-hmm. And maybe, as Audre Lorde says, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house.
Mm.
So I've been going both ways with it.
Yeah, and it is a tough edge to walk. I remember way back when I was involved in Iran-Contra, I met somebody who was early and all uninvolved with trying to expose CIA drug trafficking, and of course all the same names we've come to know and love, Bush and Cheney and all that. Mm-hmm. But he made a very telling point, and you, I have to be very honest, you give me great relief. He said, this is not a sprint, it's not a marathon, it's a relay. Mm-hmm. And as I look at your ascendancy on the stage, I am really kind of enjoying the ability to sit back and be an old guy. And let you go out and do the hard work. But you're doing it, man. So to start off with this. Of the places you have been speaking, my impression was that these are a lot of places where you encounter or would be speaking to members, if you will, of the powers that be. And
no, not too much, really.
Okay, so who is it that's got you in such hot demand?
It's mostly the choir,
okay,
and people who are almost part of the choir. But I had an interesting thought about this. Sometimes we get we criticize ourselves for just preaching to the choir, but I find that personally, I wouldn't even be in the choir if it weren't for some great preachers who kept me there when I was doubting or when I was facing some kind of difficulty and mm-hmm. ready to give up, mm-hmm. Give up being in service to this more beautiful world that we can sense on the horizon or that we can sense is possible. Like, there have been, so I'm grateful for the people who held me in that space. And also, I think that this might sound a little bit of like a corny metaphor, but the choir, the purpose of the choir is to make beautiful music.
Yes.
That other people can hear.
Yes.
And I think even if they are unwilling to hear right now and shut out that music with the din of, you know, their normal routines and consumerism or whatever, that those normal routines and consumerism aren't going to last forever. And as their world falls apart, I think that they're going to be, you know, in a state of openness and wondering what's real now, and trying to make sense of the word, of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I'm not saying that speaking, you know, preaching to the choir is the only thing we should be doing.
No.
But it's not a useless function either.
No, I mean, yeah. It could also be called tending the flock. We have to feed the choir.
Yeah.
And we have to keep those energy levels going and the energy sharing within the group. And you would seem to be, my impression of you is that you're an awesome catalyst here in the way that people respond and react to some of your stuff that is just so eloquent. I just tip my hat to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes people... you know, they'll have kind of a secret knowledge that, you know, things aren't supposed to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
And what they really need is just to hear it from outside in a way that reaches them. And that's it. So it's not just the choir I'm speaking to. Yeah.
Now, I had another impression. I watched an outstanding movie, which I'm sorry I've not seen have wider play. There's some really great movies that people hardly seem to notice, but you were in a film called Occupied Cascadia, which I adored, and I wrote an amazing review for. But there were like 10 or 15 people there who just all seemed to be, if you will, rock and roll superstars of the Gaian consciousness.
Uh-huh.
What was that experience like, and how is that film done? And just talk about that for a minute, if you would.
I don't remember that film very well. I haven't seen it.
Oh, my God.
I remember I was interviewed for it. Is it really good?
Oh, it's awesome. There's like 15 people. It's beautiful photography, a beautiful score, and there's like 15 people who are all as eloquent as you.
Wow.
I mean, and what I gleaned from that, and this is good that I'm doing a reality check with you, was that as far as I was concerned, the Gaian consciousness, which we all long for, is alive and well and firmly established. It's no longer on breast milk.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, especially, I was just, you know, the best event that I spoke at, the one that really electrified me recently was, I just spoke at a community college here in Pennsylvania.
Mm.
And the wisdom and intelligence and spiritual openness and awareness of these young people
mm-hmm.
was astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're having thoughts that no one, when I was that age, no one was having that kind of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it's second nature. You know, what took me maybe 20 years of struggle to achieve,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're almost, it's almost like they're born into it.
Now, that's kind of encouraging also from the standpoint that my perception and my feeling as we make this shift to a new consciousness is that it is going to just start to appear almost as if we had done nothing. The 7% solution, the 100th monkey.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We know that great ideas tend to appear simultaneously all over the world at the same mm-hmm. time, and we're pushing toward that critical mass.
I think that's a super important understanding to have that, you know, in some way, like the lonely work that people like you have been doing for such a long time that seemed like it was having really no effect on the world.
Yeah.
It was actually creating some kind of template or to invoke Rupert Sheldrake here, a morphogenetic field.
Yes.
That even if we can't perceive the chain of causality that that leads to a community college student choosing permaculture over business.
Mm.
Like, it's still, something's going on there. It's something that, that defies our conventional understanding of causality,
mm-hmm.
which I'll say is part of the problem. The conventional understanding of causality is that things only change when you exert a force on them. That's Newtonian mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And from that paradigm, nothing you do really matters very much because you don't have much force at your disposal
right.
compared to the powers that be.
Right.
They've got all the force. And besides, you're just one person, so it's hopeless. But that despair comes from the same place that our whole mechanized dominator civilization comes from.
Yes.
We're separate from this universe out there. We're at the mercy of natural forces and goodness. Security comes through control. That's where the whole program to control and dominate nature and each other and anything that we other comes from.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
You know, the despair and the destruction come from the same place. And I think that we're beginning to understand that the universe works in a much more mysterious ways, and therefore that the tiny invisible things that we do has a universal significance.
Yeah, I would come to look at it, looking back on my 30 years at this, is, and of course it felt that way, totally Sisyphean and mm-hmm. solitary for so many years, but what I'm beginning to get a sense of is that what we do is with our intellect or with the energy that we hold in our own consciousness, we are creating and holding a space against that which would crush it. And
yeah.
as long as we hold that space, something will come and fill it. What, does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Okay, all right. Talking about holding space, you can catch your breath, because I'm going to read the events that you're doing here in Boulder. And if you're anywhere near Colorado and you've never heard or seen Charles Eisenstein, you really want to check this out. Now, you can go to his website, which is charleseisenstein.net, or if you're on Facebook, just type in Charles Eisenstein in Boulder. There was some technical stuff, but at charleseisenstein.net, you can get all four events. Now, I'm going to read these off, and you can kind of tell us, Charles, what's different about each one. This is starting next Friday in Boulder, which is, hold on a second, I'll even tell you the date, which I can do, which is the 12th of April. The Space Between Stories, a public talk with Charles Eisenstein, is taking place, sponsored by Dream Conspiracy, Friday, April 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. in Boulder at the Integral Center at 2805 Broadway. Now, what's that going to be about? Because we got three more different events, and we'll go through each one.
Well, I never know in advance completely what I'm going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on the energy of the audience and kind of the conversations I had that day. But
yes.
The Space Between Stories refers to the this kind of it's a sacred space. When the old world or the old system of meaning falls apart, the new one usually doesn't begin right away. And you go through a time of kind of wandering, of questioning, of not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And in a traditional or a wiser society, there was space for that. You could maybe go on a walkabout, or you could go on a vision quest or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Our society doesn't give space for that, and it's seen, as, you got to figure things out.
Right.
But it's a place that really what you should do is wait for something to find you. And mm-hmm. our society is approaching that kind of space also,
mm-hmm.
where our old systems of meanings are falling apart. Most people are still clung to them, but it's getting harder and harder to deceive ourselves.
Yes.
But we don't really have a new mythology yet. And so we're kind of in the space in between. We're entering the space in between.
Yeah, so let me emphasize from my own spiritual journey and my own spiritual practice over three decades that that's a very sacred and very important place to hold. The I don't know space is a good space. That is a very productive space. We would, in spiritual practice, we would talk about the void or creating the emptiness, being free from want, to allow something to come in and fill that. And most people are terrified to death of not knowing or not having a plan. But sometimes that's the holiest thing you can do, is to just stand still and not know.
Yeah.
And embrace that not knowingness. And we are definitely in that space right now. It's getting more obvious all the time. All right, so on Saturday now, there's a screening of Occupy Love, which I'm gathering is a movie, also Dream Conspiracy. That will be from 2 to 4 p.m. in Boulder at the Boulder Public Library at 1001 Arapaho Avenue. What is that, Occupy Love?
Well, that's a film by Velcro Ripper, and Ian McKenzie is the producer. And it's a documentary on the Occupy movement. And it makes the point that the Occupy movement wasn't just like, you know, hardcore political activism, but there's a really deep, you could call it a spiritual component to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an add-on, but it's fundamental to what the whole thing was. And I don't mean spiritual in the sense of not material. I mean spiritual in the sense of affecting consciousness and relationship. It was a transformative experience for people, even if the outward effect of it wasn't obvious. You know, like, I mean, income inequality didn't change. You know, the financial system didn't change. Nothing really outwardly seemed to change very much.
Right.
But the movie says that that wasn't the significance of it.
And I totally agree. We had Graham Hancock on, I guess, 2 weeks ago now or three mm-hmm. weeks ago. And he strikes an amazing chord with his premise, his position that we are in a war for consciousness right now, and that that having adult sovereignty over our own consciousness is exceedingly important. And just thinking about that, I think, is useful. And of course, I was deeply involved in Occupy as well, and I think Occupy had ramifications that are still reverberating throughout the world today. So I'm very much looking forward to that movie. On now, this is 6 to 9 p.m. What a busy day on Saturday at the Hub in Boulder. It's at 1877 Broadway in Boulder. There's going to be a local food shift and intimate dialogue for healing and regeneration, building the restorative economy from the ground up. This is fascinating. Tell me about that and what the emphasis is on food and what's happening there.
Is that the one with Michael Schumann? And
yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, that's kind of a panel kind of thing.
Okay.
I usually hate panels. Michael Schumann, and I think Michael Brownlee's on it too. Anyway, Michael Schumann, I can't remember who else is on it at the moment, but he's a really dynamic activist for local economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to try to go into his whole spiel, but a lot more mainstream than I am. He's an attorney, really, really bright guy, though. And I think we're just going to, you know, have a dialogue.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really curious to see what kind of draw here, because Boulder is a little nest of advanced consciousness, permaculture, you grow your own organic food, marijuana,
right.
Smoke. It's my kind of people, you know.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday, to cap a busy weekend from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., good grief. This is a long workshop, I guess, Creating the More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. Great title. What are you going to be doing for 7 hours on Sunday?
Well, it's going to be a lot of interactive processes. Some of them are pretty powerful, and it gets personal, because, you know, I think every activist today is realizing that the outer work has to mirror inner work, and that we all carry habits and perceptions of the old world that make us ineffective in creating a new world, as long as those are unconscious.
As much as particle physics and new breakthroughs in the physical sciences are confirming, reaffirming, underlining, corroborating, and buttressing the scientific truth that all of what we know as physical reality is a product of vibration. And as the evidence gets clearer and clearer that consciousness is what determines reality, we find ourselves in this spot where, you know, I've heard some people say, well, just go and live your own happy, conscious reality and forget the rest of it. Well, you can't do that. You can't go live in a fifth dimensional, everything is perfect reality. And so there are always paradoxes, and we have to walk with consciousness of the world outside. But witness, and I think this is probably what you described earlier, witness the emergence of a consciousness almost coming out of nowhere. And hopefully seeing that affect our physical reality. You know, one of the things, Charles, that drove me crazy for the longest period of time was it was about 2003 when I came up with one of the standard Rupertism mantras, which is until you change the way money works, you change nothing. And I drove myself crazy between 2003 and like last year, roughly. Wondering, okay, well, if we do away with fractional reserve banking, compound interest, and fiat currency, and infinite growth, how are we going to move everything around to get everybody fed? But I had an epiphany last year when Hurricane Sandy hit New York, and Occupy Sandy stepped up and put to shame all of the relief agencies, and everything got moved, and nobody thought about it. It was just cooperation. It happened almost effortlessly, and I'm almost at the position now, especially after reading your stuff, that we don't need necessarily to go and find some kind of mechanism or create a new infrastructure or build a new anything. Once the old paradigm dies and we shift to a consciousness of cooperation, and an awareness that money was irrelevant anyway, I think everything is going to work out pretty smoothly. Now, I'm throwing that out to see what you think about that.
Well, I think that it's impossible to tell what kinds of systems we're going to build from that consciousness of cooperation or inner being. It's not a trivial question, you know, how do you coordinate? I mean, it's one thing to you know, do disaster relief, but it's another thing to, you know, over time coordinate billions of people in meeting each other's needs and you know, creating things that can only be created with millions or billions of people cooperating. And I'm not going to go into my whole argument about it. I mean, you know, some people say, well, we don't need money. You know, we could have a resource-based economy where computers run everything, or, you know, people could just give what they want and receive. There has to be some way for some way to connect gifts and needs over vast social distances when you have division of labor. Something that has to be analogous to the signaling molecule in a human body. You know, in any body that some tissue or some cell says, "Hey, I need this over here." Ultimately, money should be like that kind of signaling molecule. Obviously, the kind of money that we have today doesn't work very well.
No.
You know, unless you think "well" is defined by, I'm not even going to go there. So there's all these ideas out there. You know, I discuss some of them in Sacred Economics. There are lots of smart people out there coming up with alternative systems. But I'm kind of like you. Like, I'm kind of skeptical that the solution is going to be some smart guy comes up with the system and persuades everybody else to accept it, and then we implement this new system. I think it's going to be a much more organic, emergent transformation than that.
Yes. Well, coming up on the bottom of the hour, we're going to run tonight without a station break. I'm allowed to do that for certain special guests. But this is the nightclub at the end of the world, dude, and we have to have a song. And tonight we have a new white trash song from our new album, Inner Reach. It's a song written by Doug Lewis and me, and I'll sing the lead on this. But it carries a number of themes that are running strongly throughout all the work of consciousness. Of course, I'm heavily influenced by Native American spirituality, but there is also emphasis on love rather than fear and the higher vibrations produced by love. So, Charles, I'm going to subject you now to a new white trash song. Get ready for it.
All right.
It's called Free From, and here you go.
Set your sights high, reach for the sky, touch the unfound, don't be denied. Paint my eyes a different color and paint my face another race. Run my fingers through the water, sacred water, give me grace. I am free from fear and worry, son. I am free from all greed and hate. I am free from fear and worry, son. I am free from all greed and hate.
And you should be too, before it's too late.
Sacred sun, make wine from my hardened bones and grow these grapes. Hey, mother, grant me ground, plant a field and crops I'll raise. I'm not going, I'm not moving, I'm not leaving where I'm from. I belong here, next to you here, Holy Mother and Father, Son.
I am free from fear and worry, son. I am free from all greed and hate. I am free from fear and worry, son. I am free from all greed and hate.
And you should be too, before it's too late.
Get that together. We don't have the money to get it mixed as well as we'd like, but that's a pretty good song. We had fun with that. That's called Free From by Doug Lewis and myself. I sang the lead. Doug Lewis played the instrumentation. Backup vocals by Kristen Vigard, Jessica Hollopeter, and flute by my good friend Jesse Ray Pulver, who came up on that. So we're trying to carry some theme in there about being free from that stuff and not being possessed by hate. That's newwhitetrash.com from our new album, Inner Reach, which we're struggling to put together and get mixed. You can find that there. You can download that song for free. You can listen to it if you want to pay a buck. You're from one to a million. You can do that and help us out. But we're trying to carry the message with music. What do you think, Charles?
Well, I was thinking, I wish I was free from greed and hate.
Don't we all?
Worry.
Wouldn't we all like to be? But, you know, that's what we hold is what we want to be, where we want to go. We claim progress rather than perfection, right? Given the schedule that you're working, that stuff catches up on you. You were going to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I've been thinking, I just finished a new book. It'll be out later in the year. And one of the things I was writing about is just exploring, where does the greed and hate come from? You know, and I just look at myself when I get provoked to feeling that kind of rage and wishing that, those executives, they're going to get theirs, you know, and they'll find out, they'll be sorry then. Like, that's hate. And where does that come from? So I dig down and I realize that it's coming from a wound. You know, it's coming from something that really, really hurts. And in order to not go into the hate and the rage means that I have to let it hurt even more. The hate is kind of an escape from the full experience of the pain, you know? But I understand now that when anyone goes into hate, even if ostensibly it's for a worthy cause, the end result is going to be nothing but the image of the hate. It's going to be more and more of it. And we have to act from a different place.
And one of the things that I learned along the way in my spiritual education and journey traveling was that when you distill everything down, there are truly only two emotions, love and fear. Fear being that I'm either going to lose something that I have or I'm not going to get something that I want. And all of which are rooted in a sense of self, you know, the personal ego, which comes back to that separation. That I, Michael Rupert, or you, Charles Eisenstein, are somehow separate from all 7 billion other people, or the plants, the planet, the animals, the atmosphere, and everything else, which we are not. And it is that sense of separation, which I believe is the fundamental wound that gets inflamed, from which everything else stems.
Right. The pitfall here, though, is that if you go to war against the separation, you create more of it. And if you try to conquer fear, you end up using the same kinds of tools that make people afraid to begin with.
Yes.
You know, it's not like fear is the opposite or the enemy of love. Love can encompass fear, too. Love can you can look at yourself and say, I am afraid. And that's okay. And the fear, maybe this fear is a gift to myself that... fear creates the boundaries of our world. It keeps us safe within those boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I'm driving in a snowstorm, I feel fear, and that makes me alert. Now, there's a part of me that says, well, dying wouldn't be that bad, really. You know, we're all one, and, you know, I merge with universal consciousness. What's wrong with that? But that's...
That's the short version that leaves out a lot of detail.
Well, whatever, right? Like, my point is, like, I'm not ready to step over that boundary yet. So
right.
Fear keeps us safe within a comfortable boundary. And then what happens is we grow inside that boundary until eventually the fears that were once protective become limiting. And at that point, we desire to transcend some of the fears that are no longer serving us.
There
and
you
I think
go.
That's a really different mentality
yes.
than, okay, fear is the new bad guy, you know, the new sin or the new ego, and we're going to overcome that. This is another thing I've been writing about, that our, whatever you want to call it, a higher consciousness, our evolution into love, our letting go of fear, isn't something that we can achieve through an act of will.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's given to us. And it's also something that we can give to another person. So you were talking about separation, and very rightly, you know, you're describing how someone immersed in a story of separation and in a perception of separation is going to naturally be afraid, and is going to naturally want to control, and is going to naturally want to be greedy to add more and more to the separate self in compensation for the lost infinity of the connected self, right?
Excellent.
Like that's
yeah.
built into that sense of self.
Yes.
And so how do you change that in another person? Well, you can give them an experience that doesn't fit into the story of separation, an experience of forgiveness, an experience of receiving generosity, an experience of unconditional love.
All of
those things say, the world isn't what you thought it was.
It weakens the meme, yes.
Right. And that means that all of those little things, you know, I mean, 95% of the people are never going to be politically active, but they might be, you know, doing work in a hospice helping inner city kids in, transition, from the juvenile injustice system, or like doing these little things. And the cynic says, well, how could that make a difference? You know, we're facing global warming here. We're facing radioactive disaster. We're facing,
climate collapse, pollution.
Right.
Yeah.
And the cynic says, you know, what does it matter if you know, you're, helping some kid in inner city, you know, or a prisoner readjust to life or whatever, or helping one, veteran with PTSD. But anything that we do from a place of genuine service and from a place of love is also a political act, because everybody's times a billion, everybody's experience and story of separation forms the psychic substructure underneath all of our systems. And I'm not saying that all we have to do is help the little old lady across the street and, Ecuador will no longer be ravaged by Chinese oil companies. I'm not saying that.
Right.
But I'm saying that both kinds of activism come from the same place, and that the big activism will be more effective if it comes from that place and doesn't come from the place of those evil corporations, we're going to beat them. Because if you're pinning your hopes on beating them, defeating them in a contest of force,
right,
you're going to lose.
That's right.
So you have to rely on a change of heart. And how do you create that?
I have, over the years, I've heard three good colloquial definitions of fear, one of which I actually came up with myself. But the first one I heard was, fear is false evidence appearing real. Now, if we think from a spiritual standpoint, from the underlying reality, apart from this sense of separation that we live in this place and this time, false evidence appearing real actually is a big strength-giving thing. It makes you think about deeper truths. Then I heard a definition of fear called fuck everything and run, which is where most of the world lives. But this is especially true of my spiritual journey and the journey that Graham Hancock talked about with Mother Ayahuasca and DMT. Face everything and recover, meaning facing your own shadows and your own fears inside of yourself and watching them go away. So when we talk about fear, there's several different ways to approach it. But what I've always learned is to walk toward that which of which I am afraid. But now we have a whole world racing at Mach 1 toward everything of which it is afraid, with no knowledge of actually what's happening. But the pace toward at which the brick wall approacheth is increasing rapidly, and people are definitely going to get more scared. Does that make them more teachable? Does that open the consciousness? This is kind of the mystery school that we're in, where you go and you see, and you are so moved by just the consciousness you see emerging in young people, and that would move me too. But it's kind of hard to read, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have days where, it's things just look dark everywhere.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Do you have something or somebody to hug when that happens?
Well, I have four children. And
oh, that's good.
A lovely wife, and yeah. I find that when I get into one of those funks, though, I can't get myself out of it.
Yeah.
I need help to get out of it. And
that's
and
good.
I have the help that I need, you know, which is why I like to say that enlightenment is a group project.
Yes. You are amazingly loved, in case you didn't know that. We're down to the last 15 minutes. If anybody would like to call in and ask Charles a question or speak to him, the number is 1-888-874-4888 with Charles Eisenstein. Now, Charles, you can take a breath. I'm going to read some of your upcoming appearances here, and then I'm going to wish you some rest. April 8th, State College, Pennsylvania. You just did that. That's coming up. Geez, that's tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Okay. Boulder is next weekend. I will see you all 3 days there. I'm going to spend some time hanging out, and I'll be loving on you along with Carolyn Baker and a few of our friends, so just be prepared to be loved. 4:15, you're going to Denver, April 15th. For April 17th, Salt Lake City, Utah. Mm-hmm. Sacred Economics, 4:18, Salt Lake City. Conversation and potluck at the Common House, April 19th through the 21st, Grand Junction, Colorado, Water Comes First. May 2nd, Niagara Falls, Good Grief. May 3rd through the 5th, Toronto, details to be announced. I've had some great engagements in Toronto. I hope you have a great time. There was great people there. May 11th, the Gothenburg, Sweden lecture. You're going to Sweden?
Yeah.
May 12th through 17th, you'll be in Jarna, Sweden, the International Youth Initiative Program, 519 Copenhagen, Denmark. June 6th, Bhutan. June 14th, Ponte Alegre, Portugal. June 18th, Bristol in the United Kingdom. And at 8:25, I hope that's the end of your tour. You get to go to Esalen, and I hope you get a whole lot of massages and a whole lot of loving out there. Dude, you got to take it easy. You're as much an animal as I was when I was doing. You're going crazy. We have a caller, Malcolm from Texas, calling. Malcolm, you're on the line.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
All right, man.
Good. Well, you guys have been talking about this whole spiritual awakening in this process, and I just wanted to reference, you know, wasn't this happening during the Roman era, and wasn't Jesus sort of part of that process of making the Romans and the Jewish people aware of how sick their society had become, essentially? And just pointing them inwards and showing, and that's why he was crucified, because he really was a mirror to the Jewish people and to the Romans, just saying, look, this is how sick you've become. This is not the way you do things. This is not the way you treat each other, the world. And essentially, you know, we've had this book in front of us, which has been misused and mistaught, you know, over centuries, you know, thousands of years. Hello.
Hopefully we still have Charles.
Yep, we're still here. I'm here.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Go ahead, on the line.
Okay.
Yeah, we're all here.
So we've essentially had this book and this tool that's been misused, and if we really look at it closely, it's essentially we're repeating the same process that we've already been through before, correct?
Well, spiritual teaching would say that we are not stuck like a hamster in a wheel, that we are evolving along a spiral. And even though we come around to the same point in the circumference of a circle again, we are moving, if you will, like a slinky up a spiral of conscious evolution. Charles?
I would say it's like you know, a spiraling back more than a circling back.
Yeah.
And that historical moments of awakening were glimpses of something that was still in the future and may still be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Or even there are kind of glimpses of this event that lies outside of time that diffracts itself through, you know, onto linear time. It depends how metaphysical we want to get with this. But I think I like Matthew Fox's interpretation, where he says that the first coming of Christ was in the person of this guy Jesus. The second coming of Christ will be the advent of Christ consciousness in all human beings.
Mm-hmm. Right, the Holy Ghost. Right,
and then, like, you know, it's not dependent on the recordings of one guy in a book, which then gets, you know, edited and twisted to serve the interests of the powers that be. But because it's diffused, you know, throughout millions of people, it's able to reach critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
And Thich Nhat Hanh says something similar, that the next Buddha will be a Sangha. The next Buddha will incarnate not as one person, but as many, many, many people.
Yes.
Who maybe each one of us individually, you know, I mean, I don't think I'm particularly Christ-like or Buddha-like at all, but, you know, there is that part of me that is, and it's like this coal, you know, this ember. And by itself, it dies out. But when it's near a lot of other coals, then they all burst into flame together.
Yes.
All right.
So I look at it that way.
And that's what we're shooting for. Thank you so much for calling, Malcolm. We got another caller on the line. I appreciate you, Malcolm, in Texas. Now we got Bill in Atlanta. You out there?
I'm here. How are you guys?
All right, Bill.
You're doing good. Wow, great show, of course. So I was just going to kind of mention, you know, we always kind of talk at this level that we talk at, but there's a different level, and the different level is that if you look at everything from the present moment, and if you stop the present moment and kind of imagine that there's the momentum to the next moment, essentially nothing can be done, nothing can be changed, there's no free will, and everything is just kind of working along as it does. So essentially what I'm trying to say is there's the struggle that we're dealing with, you know, society, global warming, you know, everything else. I mean, we're pretty well done, obviously. But on the other hand, as soon as we enter the word I, and, you know, I'm trying to do this, or, you know, it's about us or whatever, then we kind of get away from the reality, which is like the tire touching the road. The part that touches the road is not moving, but contained within that moment is the next moment where the tire could be moving at 60 miles an hour and then it moves forward. So essentially the universe is kind of like already fixed and already done from front to back, and we're just kind of part of it, and we kind of see it from the I perspective.
I would not agree with that. I am really have come to hold the belief, which is subject to change, and it's just mine, that there are a number of alternative probable futures, and that given in the power of the now, this moment, as Eckhart Tolle would say, we are, with the consciousness that we carry in this moment, we are moving more in the direction of one alternative future as opposed to another. And I think, Charles, and all of us who have done this work for so, God, there's so many of us who have been out here for so long, who have carried, held a lantern at the crossroads like the hermit, we are carrying that consciousness in ourselves, which makes it possible, if you will, for the junior college students that Charles was talking about to express or manifest that consciousness at the right place at the right time. Charles, how'd I do with that? You can wrestle with that.
I have two things to say about it. One is that the cosmology that says, yeah, the universe is kind of this deterministic automaton, and you know, it's foreordained what's going to happen. I mean, that's kind of obsolete, you know, with quantum mechanics, where even the behavior of one electron is acausal.
Yes.
And a scientist says, well, it's random. Someone from a shamanic culture would say, well, the electron chooses which way it'll go.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm not saying that quantum mechanics proves that we have free will or anything like that, but I'm saying that it's a different fount of metaphor and poetic logic. And it's a counterexample to the notion that, well, the universe is just like that, you know, at bottom it's all deterministic. The second thing, though, I have to say is more of a meta comment. It's that, and this is actually consistent with what Bill was saying, you know, that...
I'm saying.
It's not that if we can only figure out the true metaphysical principles of the universe and then apply those, and everything will be figured out. It's like, you know, to me, like, I get really impatient with that. And like Bill was saying, it's more important sometimes to touch back on what's real and what's present right now. What Mike was saying earlier about you know, touching back on the unknowing, touching back on the void. We get truer knowledge that way. It's or different. It's a different path to knowing, or a different source of knowing. And I think that as our stories collapse and transform, we will have moments where that is the only source of knowledge, or the only guidance that we can look to. We'll have times where we're totally in the present moment, where we don't even know what tomorrow will bring. That's how uncertain it can be.
Yes.
And I think that spiritual practice can help us prepare for those times.
Actually, that's not exactly what I'm saying.
Go ahead.
Because everything that both of you had just said comes from a point of separateness. And if you believe, Michael, what you believe is that it's all one and there's oneness, then all of that argument completely breaks down. And that all there is only is oneness. Everything has to be 100% connected, 100% from start to back, time from before, time in the future. It doesn't matter. It's all completely connected. There cannot be any separation. And there cannot be any change, any free choice, and all of that then becomes...
No, I'm not saying that at all, and that's not my argument at all. I don't know where you got that. That's not my position.
Well, my second point was...
If you look at oneness, if you even mention oneness, then you, as soon as you say and start separating that, well, this can happen this way, or if I do this, then that, then there's not a connection there. Mike, this is huge for you because you're looking for this. This is your answer you've been searching for, okay, my friend?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying, but okay.
What I'm trying to say is this, that everything is connected. Everything.
Well, we know that.
There is not a possible improbable future. I know it seems crazy to think that from a normal perspective, but if you look at from one instant to the next, and I'm including thought, I'm including quantum mechanics.
We're running out of time, so I can't let you run over the end of the show, so you're going to have to make it short, Bill. I'm not trying to cut you off. But
dude, I totally get it. What
there
I'm
is a time limit on the show.
Look beyond. You got to look beyond. You got to put all of it in. As soon as you say even one thing that's separate, it doesn't fit. It doesn't work. All of it. Every single thing.
Okay. All right. All right, Bill. I'm sorry. I'm gonna have to cut you off. It's no offense to you. It's a good discussion, but I've got three minutes left, and I have to give it back to Charles.
I get it. No worries.
Okay. And there's semantical issues in there that are going to be too long to get through. Yes, I believe that everything came from the same place and everything is connected. I do not believe that everything is conscious of its connectedness, and that the learning process takes you through a great many levels and dimensions before you would reach a place where all mystics call it, you know, the state of enlightenment, where you are perfectly one with everything. But we don't get to live that way. As the Bible says, and as all mystical teachings say, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and unto God the things that are God's, and you have to keep your feet on the ground and your head in the clouds. Charles, we got 2 minutes left. What do you want to say?
I'll say that it doesn't matter that much what people believe,
right,
and it doesn't matter much what metaphysical principles they espouse. What matters much more is where people are acting from. And
energy,
I don't think
yes.
that it's that fruitful necessarily to you know, hash out metaphysics. It makes me feel impatient.
Yeah. I love one of Terence McKenna's lines. Terence McKenna, you know, was one of the most brilliant people in the world. He goes, for the life of me, after 35 years, I still cannot understand Buddhism. I thought that was kind of funny. But, you know, we learn, and we learn with each other, and we share with each other. And I will totally agree with you, Charles Eisenstein, on this. that the energy with which you act is as important as the action that you take.
People often think that they believe things that they don't really believe.
Yes. We are getting run out of time. We're getting run off the air. Charles Eisenstein, I love you to pieces. I'm going to see you in Boulder next week. Hopefully we can hang out, share a meal. I got some good inside stuff to tell you. Everybody go see Charles in Boulder, Colorado next week. And we will be back from there with Carolyn Baker and her house at the end of Charles's presentations on the Lifeboat Hours. Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth on the Progressive Radio Network. See you next week. Good night.
Progressive Radio Network, now on your iPod or smartphone. Go to Progressive.